This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Endure. How to work hard, outlast, and keep hammering. Written and read for you by Cameron Haynes.
Forward. Weakness haunts all men, all of them. I'm not talking necessarily about physical weakness, like being too weak to lift heavy things. No, I'm talking about the real weakness, weakness of spirit, weakness of will, the inability to take action. That is what eats at a man. Some will tell you they don't care, and they'll make convincing arguments. They enjoy being lazy. But if you could be alone with them, offering them a pill that would give them an indomitable spirit and a tireless will to succeed, they would all take it. All of them. Every last fucking one of them. Weakness haunts us all. The times we could have done more eat at your self-esteem. They rob you of your self-respect and diminish your belief in your potential. We've all had moments where we could have done more but didn't. The true art of a full life is to minimize those moments when your inner bitch wins the battle and maximizes your ability to rise and grind. There is an art to this. Unfortunately, most of us don't treat our lives like a work of art. The vast majority of us will leave this life like an unfinished canvas, a dim shadow of what we could have been if we had dedicated ourselves to mastering the mind and consistently forcing the body into action. We will apply some effort when the motivation is there, but more often than not, we will find an excuse to nap and complain rather than to push ourselves to perform past the threshold of our comfort zone. It is a very rare person who can lay down at the end of the day with a full confidence that they have done their absolute best, and an even rarer person that can do that consistently, day after day, year after year, until the days of laziness and self-pity are but a distant memory drowned out by the years and years of action and discipline. There is an art to this, and one of the modern masters of this art is my good friend, Cameron Haynes. To the uninitiated, a quick glance at his Instagram page would reveal a bow hunter who enjoys lifting weights and running trails. But to truly understand Cam requires a much more careful and prolonged study. He is a master at one of the art forms that gets the least amount of attention, the art of the maximized life. In this work, layers upon layers of effort and discipline create a depth and texture to the life that's lost during a cursory examination by a person who doesn't know what they're seeing. It is an art form, with only the people who are also out there grinding, truly understanding and appreciating how amazing this consistent effort is. Look up the hashtag #KeepHammering on Instagram. As of this writing, there's more than 449,000 posts, all of them inspired by the way Cameron Haynes lives his life. In his world, there are no days off. Days where you are not getting better are days wasted. The hammering never ends, and the inner bitch never has a chance. Many people talk this kind of talk. In fact, pretending you're a savage is disgustingly common. Many of these posers will post motivational quotes on social media and even give out unsolicited advice on how to chase your dreams and follow your goals. But my guess is that if you could randomly peer into their lives, you would probably catch most of these motherfuckers eating snacks and checking their posts for likes. One of my favorite Cam Haynes quotes is, "Nobody cares, work harder." It's such a perfect statement for this day and age when grown men are using beauty filters on their Instagram pictures and everyone is pretending they're exceptional. We live in a world today where it's never been easier to be full of shit. But on the flip side, the beauty of this time is that when you come across someone who's truly, undeniably smashing life, you appreciate it like a starving man being served up a juicy elk steak. I'm going to describe some of the things he does, and the list is so preposterous that it seems like bullshit. He regularly runs a marathon a day. I read once that if you run a marathon, it takes your body 6 months to fully recover. I don't know who wrote that, but someone needs to tell that silly bitch there's a guy in Oregon with a full-time job with the Department of Water and Power who runs multiple marathons every week. Sometimes he'll get up at 3 a.m. and run a full marathon before work. Then he'll come home from working 8 hours, practice archery, lift weights, and do it all over again the next morning. He's run multiple 100-mile races and several over 200 miles. These require days and days of running without rest. Tune into his Instagram a few days after he's back from one of these self-imposed, soul-crushing torture sessions, and you will see him with a big smile on his face running again or hitting the weights. Now, if you told me 10 years ago that there was a guy out there doing all this while holding down a full-time job and a family, I would have looked at you the same way I'd look at someone who tells me their best friend is Bigfoot. Maybe I would have believed there's someone out there who can do all this, but I would have assumed there's some science project being constantly fed performance-enhancing drugs by a team of doctors monitoring his body around the clock to make sure he doesn't drop dead from overexertion. But if you told me that all this is being done by some smiling bow hunter with a 40-hour-a-week job, I'd have told you to get the fuck out of here with that nonsense. It doesn't seem possible, but yet it's a fact. And what's perhaps even more impressive is that while he's doing all these things, he's also managed to become the best bow hunter on Earth. You see, that's where this whole Cameron Haynes story gets even more unusual. His obsession with physical performance is purely to ensure that he is at his best for his real passion, bow hunting elk in the mountains. Hunting for wild elk in the mountains with a bow is an incredibly difficult thing to be successful at. The terrain is rugged, and the elk have senses honed to a razor's edge by millions of years of evolution. It requires you to get inside of 100 yards, undetected, on an animal that has been avoiding mountain lions, bears, and wolves for its entire life, and then, under extreme pressure, to release a perfect arrow into the animal's vitals. Because of all these factors, success rates for archery elk hunting are quite low. The average is somewhere below 10%. Even elite hunters will often come home empty-handed. Cameron Haynes, on the other hand, has been successful on every single archery hunt he's been on over the last 10 years. It's almost impossible to overemphasize how extraordinary that is. His insane dedication to fitness and his maniacal pursuit of perfection in the mountains have made him the boogeyman for mountain elk and an incredible inspiration to fellow hunters like me. There's literally no one like him, a rare freak of a man with a singular obsession, be the best bow hunter that he can be. Fueled by wild meat and superhuman discipline, he has turned his life into a masterpiece of dedication and focus. And long after he is gone, when men sit around the campfire and tell hunting stories, his name will be brought up with reverence and hushed tones. I am proud and honored to call him one of my best friends. Joe Rogan, October 2020.
Life is never made unbearable by circumstances. but only by a lack of meaning and purpose. Viktor Frankl. Prologue, Answering the Call. Every epic adventure begins with the call. Rocky Balboa gets the invitation to box Apollo Creed for the title. King Leonidas from 300 refuses to submit to the messenger from King Xerxes and kills him instead, guaranteeing a war. Will, from Good Will Hunting, gets to stay out of jail only if he answers a call to work with Professor Lambeau on math problems and attends therapy. My call came from Roy Roth. He had been a grade above me at Mohawk High in Marcola, a small logging community at the edge of the Willamette Valley in Oregon, near the city of Eugene. We weren't super close in high school, but everybody knew each other since it was a small school. I called Roy the quote guru because I knew he was a passionate hunter who was always out in the woods and ran a trap line, which meant he knew animals better than most. Trappers, if they have any success, are dialed in on wildlife. Back then when I hunted with a rifle, I would tell my friends, I'm going to call the guru and see where he thinks we should go on opening day. His invitation was simple. Dude, you need to bow hunt. At the time, I was 19 years old and going nowhere. I worked part-time at a warehouse, earning $4.72 an hour, and I attended a community college the other half of the time. I spent weekend mornings outside trying to take photos of deer and elk, and the afternoons and evenings drinking beer and doing nothing but listening to Hank Williams Jr. I was basically a small-town loser. After hearing all of Roy's stories and how great bow hunting was, I decided to buy a bow the following year. It was 1988, and I was 20 years old. My first bow was a $200 Golden Eagle Super Hawk Turbo Cam. Since it was shiny black instead of camo, I spray painted it myself using ferns for the pattern in matte green and black paint. My bow was set at 90 pounds, and I shot super light arrows trying to get speed out of them. This combo made it very loud, so I tried to quiet it by duct taping a 35mm film canister between the quiver and the riser to hold everything tight as the quiver rattled. It came as no surprise that the bow eventually broke in half at the grip when I was at half draw shortly after that first bow season. The first day I ever bow hunted, opening day of archery season in 1989, I went with Robbie Dunson, who lived down the road from me in Marcola, Oregon. He was 19 years old when he bow-killed a world record Roosevelt bull, a species of elk on the West Coast. His dad, Dean Dunson, at the time, had killed the number 4 biggest ever Roosevelt bull. Bulls are very big and can weigh up to 1,200 pounds on the hoof, live weight. I've always been attracted to people who are the best at whatever they do, knowing there is no one better to learn from, so I enjoyed hanging out with the Dunsons and asking them questions about bow hunting elk. The Dunsons knew archery hunting for Roosevelt elk as well as anyone on earth at that time. I went to their house and shot my bow nearly every day. That first morning, I went out with Robbie. We were sitting by a thick section of reprod, which is a logging country term for young timber, when I heard the high-pitched bugle of a male elk. The 15-foot-tall trees shifted like the parting of the seas, and a massive bull stepped out onto the logging road. I was leaning on my knees, trying to look invisible as a black-horned 6x7 bore holes through me with his eyes. He was in bow range, and when I decided that I should try to kill him, the one thing I'd been practicing to do for months, I realized that it felt like my arms were asleep and my heart was beating out of my chest. I don't know if I can even pull this bow back. The bull stood there, only 40 yards away from me. There was no question I should be able to kill him. I'd shot thousands of arrows at this distance all summer. I pulled back the bowstring and released. The arrow missed the bull, shot behind his butt. That meant I was about 7 feet off my mark, which was ridiculous. That was what I'd call shitting the bed. My first bow shot of my life at an animal couldn't have been much worse. I didn't get another opportunity that day, but something was ignited inside of me. I'd never had any real ambitions or goals for myself, but something changed. Now all I knew was that I wanted to kill a bull. So right after that first day hunting debacle, I became obsessed and hunted for the next 18 days straight, determined to succeed. That's right, 18 days straight. Finally, on September 13th, 1989, I killed my first bull. The first animal that ever died from one of my arrows was a spike bull. Granted, it wasn't anything like the giant 6x7 I blew it on, but it didn't matter. It was my first bow kill and my first bull elk. Truth is, I didn't deserve a big bull yet. I hadn't paid my bow hunting dues. And size aside, I didn't know many guys who had even killed a bull with their bow. So my spike bull accomplishment still felt special. It was an almost 3-week grind, but it was worth it. Some people live their whole lives never finding their true passion. I was 20 years old when I first tasted bow hunting success, and that marked the time I discovered my purpose. Suddenly, I had something in my life to focus my energy on. I quit college and quit about everything else just to be able to bow hunt more. I'll never forget where this journey began and how long it's taken to hammer away at a dream. We all have to start somewhere. Nobody's born great at bow hunting. Bow hunting is not easy. Spending day after day in the unforgiving mountains to hunt is a feat on its own, but adding the extra challenge of doing it with a bow takes that challenge to another level. That's what drew me to the time-honored tradition of bow hunting. At times, it feels nearly impossible to get within bow range of an animal and kill it with essentially a sharp stick. The elk live in the mountains every day of the year, sleeping, eating, keeping a wary eye out for predators, surviving. Imagine sleeping under a tree one night. It would be absolutely miserable, but elk do it every single day in rugged country. It's no wonder they are as tough as they are. So when you're bow hunting them, you have to be close, within 40 yards ideally, in their quote red zone, which means you have to outwit them. The average success rate on hunting a bull elk with a bow is about 10%. So that's one kill every 10 years, or one guy out of 10 who's going to have success. That's never going to be good enough for me. Never was, never will be. Average sucks. Nowadays, I earn success on virtually every hunt, in every state, every year. So I expect to be 100% when the average is 10%. That said, I didn't wake up one morning great at bow hunting. I have worked for more than 30 years to get where I am today. It's not talent, it's drive. It's not raw ability, it's endurance. Hunting is my passion, and being successful at it is what fuels me every day to get better than the day before. That's how I'm able to have a 100% success rate. Regardless of how it may appear, this book isn't about bow hunting. It's not an advice book. I don't tell people what to do, nor do I try to speak for others. I just share what I do and what I'm passionate about, because life without passion is simply existence, in my opinion. We are all hunters in a sense, searching for a more meaningful life. Too many times, the weight of this world becomes too heavy to carry through the mountains, so we turn back towards safer, more comfortable conditions. Too often, we find ourselves waiting and wondering when success will find us. This book will provide the motivation to keep moving, to stay steadfast, and to be ready for that moment. Rather than a book about hunting, this is a book about enduring. I love the word endure. That's what life is all about. There are hard times. It's a long race. Sometimes it can feel like a battle. But for those of us not born with it, greatness is easy to give up on. There are countless excuses that keep people from going after an extraordinary life. But when we take on the challenge of pushing our limitations, we no longer see our limitations as barriers, but as chances to work hard and buck the odds. In order to live a life marked by passion, tenacity, focus, and resilience, you have to simply keep hammering. Keep hammering isn't some clever motto. It's a wake-up call to meaning. It's a reference that reminds us to pound away at the lie of impossible. I get a lot of people who reach out to me feeling like they can't get started. For most of them, they can't get any momentum going. What I tell them is that you just have to get out the door and worry about today only. Don't worry about tomorrow. Don't worry about a week from now. You worry about today. Win the day. Do something positive. Worry about tomorrow, tomorrow. To me, that is what enduring means, to get some positive direction going, to build up some momentum. What you're barely doing day one, you're doing easily on day 20. That's how it works. You have to get started, and then you have to endure. A life well lived isn't a sprint down a smooth track, but a steady jog up a rocky trail. Even if you are born a natural runner, the race of life involves preparation, perseverance, and a resistance to passivity. This is your call to adventure. Let's take the journey together. picture a place you haven't been, a road you've been longing to travel down, a destination you've dreamt of reaching. I don't know the directions you need to take, and I won't suggest you follow my path. God knows I've taken detours and wandered down a path twice as long as it needs to be. I'm not equipping you with all the necessary tools, nor am I giving you the map. All I'm asking is that you get up and go. I don't give answers. I take action. I'm not trying to educate. I'm leading by example. I don't talk about tomorrow. I live out today. I don't know the end result, but I promise you one thing. I know how to endure the race. Part 1. Pray. Average effort yields average results. Chapter 1. Life is suffering. Running has always made me feel free. Even though I was in my mid-30s before I entered my first marathon, I've been running my whole life. I started school a year earlier than most kids, and I can still picture my 5-year-old, first grade self, running before school every day. A 5-year-old grinding before school? Apparently. When I attended Dunn Elementary, they had a jogging contest where we had 1 month to run as far as we could on our own time and to keep track of how many miles we accumulated. I arrived on the school property early every day to run back and forth, from fence to fence, which marked the school perimeter. Doing this 31 times represented 1 mile. My first year of doing this, first grade school year, I ran 20 miles in the jogging contest. And in second grade, when I was 6 years old, I ran 27 miles. To break it down, there are about 20 school days per month, so my self-imposed goal as a 5-year-old was 1 mile per day before school. The next year, I wanted to do better. My mother kept the certificates the school awarded me for doing this extra work on my own time. Quote, "This shows a willingness to exercise when you do not have to," the certificate reads. Every day I came home saying how far I ran. I was striving toward a goal and receiving positive encouragement. Looking back, I realized that maybe I was running to try and cope with my parents' divorce and to attempt to connect with a dad who is no longer in my life. The biggest legend around Eugene, Oregon, when I was a kid was long-distance Olympic runner Steve Prefontaine. But for me, it was my dad. Bob Haynes was Superman in my eyes. In a town known as Tracktown, USA, my dad excelled at the sport. He earned a full-ride scholarship at the University of Oregon in gymnastics and, after flunking out there, earned a full ride at Oregon State for track where they wanted him to pole vault and high jump. In high school, he was around 6 feet tall and he could high jump 6'4". My dad did what was called the Western Roll, where the high jumper crosses the bar, facing it with the stomach facing down as he passes over it. At the time, he was friends with, and as stories indicated, competed against Dick Fosbury from Medford, Oregon, who won the gold medal in the high jump at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. During my dad's and Dick's high school years, Dick invented a new method of jumping, which would be named after him. The Fosbury flop is what high jumpers do today, jumping back first and kicking their legs up to clear the bar as they glide over. The track coaches came to my dad and said they felt he could potentially add a foot to his jump if he performed the Fosbury flop. If they are right, theoretically that meant he'd jump 7'4". Fosbury's gold medal jump was 7'4¼", which also happened to be a new Olympic record. My dad never changed the jumping method and never competed for Oregon State, which is where Fosbury ended up and jumped for in college. Back then, my dad was more interested in partying than being a serious athlete. He'd been consumed by sport and being the best his whole life, so maybe he was burned out. Bob Haynes was a great athlete at South Eugene High School. In a school that saw all sorts of amazing athletes gracing its hallways, my dad was a first inductee into South Eugene's Athletic Hall of Fame. Even years after he graduated, his fellow classmates still remembered him. When our daughter was practicing for the pole vault one day, a couple of her coaches came up to me to ask about Taryn. "Is she Bob Haynes' granddaughter?" I nodded. "Yeah, Bob was my dad." "You know, your dad was a legend around here," one of the coaches said. "Yep, that's what I've heard. When you grow up hearing more about your dad than seeing him, his legend only grows in your young mind. He and my mom, Linda Brown, met at South Eugene. I never forgot something she told me when I was 5 years old. Your dad's legs are so muscular, they're as hard as this wood table, she said as she pointed at our oak coffee table. Little comments like that made him seem larger than life. Perhaps it was a blessing in disguise that my dad didn't get more of the individual glory in athletics, because he ultimately became known as an amazing track coach at South Eugene. He coached state champions in the long jump, triple jump, and pole vault. With a career lasting more than 30 years, my dad made an impact on thousands of kids' lives. I still get messages from students he coached and what a positive influence he was in their lives. Bob Haynes knew how hard it could be growing up and navigating life in general. His own dad died when he was only 3 years old, shot in an alley in Seattle. He cared so much for the kids he coached and always enjoyed helping them discover what they loved to do. He believed in them. Before my dad could become a legendary high school coach and teach kids to win, he first needed to overcome his own personal battle he was going through. On May 30th, 1975, Steve Prefontaine died in an automobile accident. Earlier that evening, Steve had won a 5,000-meter run at University of Oregon's Hayward Field. He was only 24 years old. The place where he crashed on the winding, narrow Skyline Boulevard is now known as Pre's Rock. 4 years earlier, another car accident happened only 10 minutes from Pre's Rock. Nobody got killed, but it might have helped tear a family apart. It's one of my earliest memories of my parents when they were still married. In fact, it's one of my only memories. I was 4 years old, and I woke up hearing my mother yelling. I went to find her standing by the door, heading into the garage, talking loudly and frantically to my dad. When I stepped to her side and followed her eyes, I noticed the side of my dad's car was damaged as if he had just hit another vehicle. I didn't know this at the time, but my dad was an alcoholic. Thankfully, Bob Haynes was able to walk away from this accident. Not long after that, my parents divorced. In a subsequent accident, my dad crashed near some train tracks and wound up in a coma for 3 days with head trauma. Another near miss. My mom had a job at the phone company, so she worked in downtown Eugene and was gone a lot. I wonder now if I started elementary school early because my mom needed a break from me, as I was oftentimes acting out after the divorce. She was probably thinking to herself, I've got to work, so get this kid out of my hair. He can start school a year earlier than most. My grade school is just up the hill from our house, so I walk to and from school every day. After writing this section, I asked my mom about those days, and she said starting me early wasn't to give her a break. She said I was a smart little boy and that I was ready for school. Even though I enjoyed the jogging challenge I entered in first and second grade, I struggled with behavior problems. With my mom gone at work, I was what's known as a, quote, latchkey kid. Coming home from school alone, letting myself in, and looking out for myself until mom got home from work later in the evening. To occupy myself, I usually caused damage. I once cut up the screen door screen with a knife, hit a neighbor kid in the head with a fist-sized rock after I threw it across East 39th Street, stole candy from the local Safeway, and so on. One day in the first grade, while the teacher stepped out of the room, I went up to the chalkboard and wrote F-U-K in big, bold letters. This and other issues got me put on the red light, green light program. If I behaved well at school, they put me on green light and gave me a green card to take home. But if I was bad in class, they put me on red and sent me home with a red card. I can't recall how often I got a red card compared to green, but it was a measurable thing. One thing has always stayed consistent from then to now. I love measurables. Green light might have meant a good day, but life didn't get any better, however. Not long after the divorce, my mother began dating. I mean, who could blame her? She was a beautiful, green-eyed, 20-something single mother of two boys. I hated it when she'd leave on dates, and I hated the guys she dated because they weren't my dad. I couldn't believe she'd bring another man into our house. I remember saying, Mom, I want it like the old times, just us and Dad. Eventually, she remarried, and my stepdad, Greg, entered the picture. I didn't like him at all, mostly because he wasn't my dad. They had one thing in common, though. They both had drinking problems, so he brought with him the very same issues that had driven my dad away. My childhood soon became some never-ending race I could never win as I bounced back and forth between my parents. There's always got to be a bad guy in every movie, and for me, it was my stepdad. I wanted to spend time with my dad and to get his approval, but instead, I got the stranger suddenly showing up and telling me how to live my life. He worked for a paving company, and he drove a roller, so all day long he sat in the sun, on hot asphalt, smoking cigarettes. He would come home and drink, see me, and in my mind, think of shit to do to screw with me. Here's one thing about Greg, my stepdad. He's freaking tough as shit. He grew up in a small town in eastern Oregon, and his family owned a big ranch. Ranching is hard-ass work, so they were as tenacious as they come. Greg had two brothers and two sisters, all tough farm kids who grew up to become tough people. Even later in life, after he got sober, he was one tough old bastard, running a 100-mile ultra at the age of 70. I may not have liked him for years, but I've always respected his toughness. And I wonder now if maybe, in his mind, being hard on me was an attempt to make me tough for life. I get tough love, but there's no love in this equation. When I was a kid, my stepdad always seemed to be in a bad mood. He was mean whenever he was drinking, which was often. Once I had to stack 7 cords of wood, and after I finished, my stepdad thought they weren't stacked well enough, so I'm pretty sure he knocked a bunch of it over and told me to do it again. He didn't work in the winter, as the guys who work for paving companies usually get laid off and collect unemployment, so my stepdad was around more than either of us liked. One time we had a terrible confrontation in the kitchen that turned physical. "Take the chicken scraps out," he told me one morning before school. "You take them out," I said. "You're going to be sitting here all day not doing anything." We wound up on the floor of the kitchen with his veiny, dark tanned arm around my neck. I probably deserved it. I didn't like him, so I didn't show him any respect during those years. My stepdad was not a bad person, but when you did these sorts of things, you weren't going to get a good review from your stepkid. When things got really bad, I would go live with my dad, but that meant leaving my mother and younger brother. Pete is 2.5 years younger than me, so he was very young when my parents divorced, and he didn't really know our dad. He knew our stepdad better, so when he started calling Greg Dad, it felt like a knife in my gut. "You're not doing that," I told him. "I very much regret doing it now, but I would beat Pete up just to make him go see our dad." I was always worried about how my dad felt. Pete never had a connection with our dad, so it made sense for him to accept our stepdad, but I wasn't about to. "No, I'm never accepting this guy," I told myself, all because I felt like I needed to have allegiance to my dad. Looking back on it now, I would hate to put my kids through something like this. Kids shouldn't have to deal with that kind of shit. My childhood sucked, and it was something hard that I had to endure. But honestly, I don't wish I had a better childhood because it's made me who I am today. We all have struggles, and the struggles can define who you are. It's all part of the journey. Some of those struggles come from unexpected places and unpredictable situations. In the same way you can't control the weather, your life will be filled with unexpected storms that can hit hard and either break you, toughen you up, or simply teach you about the darker parts of life that don't get featured in Hallmark movies. When I was in 3rd and 4th grades, my mom worked with and became friends with this lady at the phone company. I remember her being very nice and pretty. They went out on weekends, leaving Pete and me with a woman's teenage sons to babysit. My stepdad had a Harley, and so did the husband of my mom's friend. So I think they would go on road trips or maybe just out for the night. While it was a long time ago, and I don't remember all the details, there are a few things I do remember that might always haunt me. The teenage brothers weren't the greatest babysitters. They used drugs and made me and my brother fight in front of their friends. They'd yell and scream and treat it like entertainment, coaching us on how to hit each other hard. Whenever there was blood, the boys yelled louder and got more fired up. Pete and I didn't like it, but I don't remember us having a choice, or maybe it was a way for us young boys to try to earn the approval of older boys. The brothers watched us at our house as we had a pool table, and they and their friends had something to do as they acted crazy and got drunk and high during those stressful nights. They made me smoke pot so I couldn't tell on them. We'd do whatever they said. So I smoked pot, and then they'd put shaving cream in my mouth, as they said it'd mass a scent of pot. The younger brother did most of the communicating with us and said if we told on them, they would tell my mom that I smoked pot too. If I hadn't already learned that life wasn't always going to be fun and loving, I did then. My young eyes were open to the fact that there were people in this world you could never trust and would hurt you for entertainment. Teenage boys have zero compassion as it is, but these two brothers were beyond bullies. Once they got me going so fast on a steel merry-go-round at the park that I got scared and jumped off, cracking my head open on the pavement. The back of my head was split open and there's lots of blood, but they made me tell my mom I fell on my own. I think I ended up telling her the truth. I still remember that blood-soaked, blue and white striped shirt and them laughing, "Oh shit, your head is fucked up." My mom didn't know it at the time, and probably their mom didn't know it either, but in my eyes, the babysitting brothers were evil. I didn't tell my mom all they did to us until many years later. Ultimately, the older brother overdosed on heroin and died in a park in Eugene, while the younger one took some hallucinogenic mushrooms and killed his best friend with a knife when he was only 15. Since he was a juvenile, he got out for that murder in his 20s, but then he was involved in another murder and went back to prison for many years. He's out again now. In middle school, I lived with my dad in Eugene while my brother lived with our mother and stepdad in Marcola. I missed Pete like crazy. I'd often cry just thinking about my brother and how much I missed him. I had a paper out, so I woke up at 4 a.m. to deliver papers. Sometimes I'd be outside riding my bike in the cold rain, and I had a lot of time to think. Every day in the summer during the stretch, I would also pick strawberries and beans later in the morning for Evanooks after I delivered papers. My goal was to earn $10 a day for BMX stuff. During this period of my life, with all that time to be in my own head, one constant thought came to mind. This sucks. Happiness seemed like a foreign concept. Pain was a constant. Nothing about my life in middle school stood out. I was pretty miserable, even when it came to sports. Despite the competitive spirit inside me, I wasn't a natural athlete. Nothing ever came easy. My dad's genes hadn't been passed down to me, it seemed, so I realized that I had to work hard at everything if I hoped to compete. Since my dad was some legendary track guy, I decided to attempt to follow in his footsteps. During one particular track meet, I was excited to see my stepmom, Candy, come watch me, knowing that she was going to tell my dad how I did. He wasn't there himself, but his spirit loomed large like it always did. It was really hard to get his attention in athletics since he was gone traveling around with junior national teams. You couldn't just do regular shit and be celebrated. I knew I had to make my mark, so I decided I would do it in the 800-meter race at that meet. Our middle school district track meet was held at Springfield High School, which was a big deal, as they had a nice rubber track and grandstands. I was wearing all green, which was the color of my middle school, the Hamelin Loggers. When the gun went off, I took off as if it were a 200-meter dash. I ran like Steve Prefontaine, going out hard and refusing to let go of the lead. For a short while, a very short while, I raced at the front, but by the end of the first lap, I was dying. I still remember the guy who won the race, Greg Suter. He was a natural track guy who won all the time. He looked like a runner, tall and lean. I was this short-legged kid, gasping at the end of the race and finishing last. I was thankful my dad hadn't accompanied my stepmom to this meet. This was my normal. I just didn't have it. That's what I grew up with. Life has always been a grind. Life has always been a grind, but maybe at this point, it was more than a grind. Maybe it was just plain awful. Obviously, for kids, a parent's divorce is always hard. What kid doesn't want a mom and dad around to love them, ask them how their day went, give them guidance, and help them grow? That wasn't my life. And when I was living with my dad, he was never around because he was working at his record store, Vintage Vinyl in Portland, trying to keep it afloat. And I was now separated from my brother. All I remember feeling was alone, sad, and in pain. So yeah, it was a grind. Why run is a question often asked. Steve Prefontaine once penned in a high school essay, "Why go out there every afternoon and beat out your brains? What is the logic of punishing yourself each day, of striving to become better, more efficient, tougher?" This was a question that I would come to ask myself, and come to be asked quite frequently the older I became. Prefontaine's answer sums up his legendary mindset. He said, "The value in it is what you learn about yourself. In this sort of situation, all kinds of qualities come out. Things you may not have seen in yourself before. This can refer to running a tough race, or it can relate to enduring a terrible childhood. What do you learn about yourself even in dire situations. I have to acknowledge and thank my stepdad. He was the one who initially got me started in hunting. There's an irony in the fact that my biggest hero growing up never hunted. He had no use for hunting. My dad used to sarcastically make fun of me and say, every time you kill an animal, you lose a brain cell. Of course, I know he is proud of my accomplishments as a hunter. After my first book on hunting, Boney Trophy Blacktail, came out, my dad went to bookstores and got them to buy half a dozen copies. He supported and loved me, but he still never hunted. My stepdad was the one who took my brother and me hunting with him. Perhaps my mother urged him to do something with the boys. Hunting was something most rural people did. For some, it was more of a casual hobby, and they definitely didn't train for it like an athletic event back in those days. I was not a good hunting partner at the time because I wore big-legged jeans that made lots of noise when I walked. I was never quiet. My stepdad would be smoking a cigarette as we crept along, and he would mostly just get mad because we were making too much noise. As a result, I never really enjoyed hunting with him, but he did get me started when I was 15 years old and my brother was 12. I have to hand it to my stepdad. Not only did he take my brother and me hunting, but he took us out to this big deer hunting camp over in eastern Oregon that his brothers went to. I know now how big a deal this happened to be. These grown men likely didn't want kids around. I know I wouldn't have if I had been them. I guarantee when Pete and I showed up, they were looking at themselves going, what is this, freaking daycare? They wanted to get together to hunt, drink, and play poker at night in the camp tent. But my stepdad bit the bullet and took us. I killed my first deer thanks to him. My brother and I were on our own when I killed a young spike. I had a beat-up 300 Savage with a cheap 4-power scope, and I thought I saw horns, so I put the crosshairs behind the deer's shoulder and hammered the shot off from 150 yards. After I fired the shot, my brother looked at me with surprise. You shot a doe? That wasn't a doe, I told him. But suddenly I had doubts. Oh shit, did I kill a doe during buck season? When we got to the deer, thank God there was an antler spike growing out of its head. It was legal, but only barely. My stepdad didn't see me make my first kill, and we never went hunting together again that I remember. But he got me started on that path as a hunter. His taking us to that hunting camp was probably a disaster for him, but it was life-changing for me. Don't ever prejudge who can and cannot make an impact in your life. Even the most unlikely of people can turn out to be instrumental in your journey. Maybe the villain in your story is actually just an anti-hero in disguise. It's easy to use your childhood as a crutch instead of seeing it as a chisel. There are a lot of divorces out there, so that means a lot of kids come from broken homes. I always hear people say, my family is so dysfunctional, using it as an excuse for something. But it's not really a valid excuse, because everybody's family is dysfunctional in some way. There are so many crutches people want to use to justify themselves, but for me, you have to eliminate every single one of them. Get rid of all of them. Then tell yourself it's up to you. What are you going to do now that you've let go of all those crutches? I could blame alcoholism on a shitty childhood, but I don't. Blaming others is an easy way out. It was too easy to look at my stepdad's drinking and become indignant. But I could have easily had the same sort of problem. Everything I do is to the extreme. So when I did finally start drinking when I got older, I was all in. I would get drunk as hell. If I hadn't straightened my life out, I couldn't have blamed anybody except myself. I know my dad was an alcoholic too, and it greatly impacted my life. But I'm not perfect either, so I can't judge him. He had a lot of potential that he never got to take advantage of because of drinking in the prime of his athletic career. Cancer took him in 2010 at the age of 63, which seems pretty young to die from cancer. He had been sober and lived a clean life for more than 30 years, so who knows why he got cancer. I think he had a lot of regret, but sometimes that's just life and how it plays out. He's the reason why I am the way I am today. Even though I didn't get to be around him as much when I was a kid because of the divorce and because he stayed busy with his record store, Vintage Vinyl, we got very close before he died, and I saw the impact he had on people. He was always who I wanted to make proud. My dad never lived up to his full athletic potential, but he put me on a path so I could live up to mine. I recently told my mom that I'm so glad I went through what I went through. All that shit, being miserable and hating my stepdad and hating my life. feeling like I was never happy. I'm glad I was forced to weather those storms. In some ways, that's why I'm good at what I do now. We all grow up having to rely on people, our parents, family, friends, neighbors, teachers. I didn't have anybody to rely on, so that meant I had to do things for myself. If I didn't push myself, and there was a time I was quite happy not pushing myself, there was nobody else there to push me. I found a true passion and calling in bow hunting, and I found the perfect person to push me with it. But when Roy ended up moving to Alaska, I had to make a choice to either go hunt by myself or not go, because I couldn't get anybody who wanted to do it with me. Of course, I went hunting by myself, and I was comfortable doing this because I had grown up being independent and being on my own. Not by choice, but just because that's how life can work out. Sometimes I hear someone give a familiar excuse when it comes to working out. Yeah, I was lifting good, hard, in a groove, and then my partner's work schedule changed, so he couldn't make it. What does that have to do with anything? Who cares? It's not about somebody else, it's about you. Being on my own made me tougher. It made me independent and allowed me not to have to rely on others to become a good problem solver. I had to use my imagination because nobody else was there to use it for me, and I became creative and resilient. My dad's absence and my stepdad's antipathy helped me overcome my averageness. Of course, I first needed to go through high school to discover how truly average I happened to be. I've become good friends with Payne over the years, as he's with me in all my most memorable and rewarding challenges. What are you passionate about? What is the one thing you could never give up? How much would you endure to never let it go? All you need to have is a passion and a will to sacrifice greatly. That's enough. That's all I've ever had. Love the struggle. Life gives perspective. Suffering grants power. The experiences of my life, mostly from the adversity, have given me perspective I haven't always had. I've come to love the struggle. How much pain and suffering will you go through for success? On most of my hunts, this is what probably has made the biggest difference, the ability to suffer more, to battle through the burdens, to fight my fears and self-doubts. Fighting is part of me. It's one reason I'm very thankful for my upbringing despite the pain. Suffering in silence for hours, working toward that finish line. It's what I love about the journey that is mountain endurance running. I write and talk about the work required to succeed in the grand tradition of bow hunting. It's a special journey that is humbling. It takes pain. It requires devotion. It supplies anguish. It rewards achievements beyond belief. It creates seasoned veterans. The journey is long, so long. Running miles in the early morning and during lunch and the afternoon, I want to sweat and be miserable. That is always my goal. Train for misery and embrace the pain. This is my approach because you know you'll experience it in the mountains. I want to find my limits. I want to find out what happens when I push myself too far. Haven't been there yet, but I can't wait. There are many days I hurt when I run. Ankles, knees, hips, the list goes on. I've put in many, many miles, and after doing so for years, you're going to be nicked up. Either you quit or you push through the aches. I push. I ignore it. I'm pretty sure no one has ever died from a blister. I love training and working hard toward my goals, be it bow hunting, running, lifting, or otherwise. My past pain serves as a life preserver in the wilderness. My painful history helps carry the heavy load in the mountains. When my shoulders ache, my back tightens, and my quads engage, I feel the hunt has finally given the one thing I long for. Obviously, the suffering endured while packing meat out means success, but it represents more than that. The dripping sweat and fight for solid footing gives me what I need. I've come to long for and embrace the struggle. Without it, I am not me. Chapter 2, Pushing Above Average. Success starts with confidence. As I look back over my life, for most of it, I see an up and down journey, a never-ending battle to earn above average. The passion has been there since my first bow hunt, but there have always been whispers of wondering whether it's all worth it. There's been a target on my back, being judged by everything I say and do, or maybe it's just been my own doubt that magnifies the negative energy others put out there. Confidence is so tough to earn and so easy to lose. It almost doesn't seem fair. But once you have confidence, you begin to work hard, and that's when you begin to find success. As a freshman entering a new high school, I had no confidence and zero success to point to or build momentum off of. Life got worse after I decided to live with my dad when he moved to Portland. Suddenly, I found myself at this big school I didn't want to attend or I didn't know anybody. I struggled in my classes. I earned mostly D's as a freshman. I ate like shit and wasn't active, so I started gaining weight, and to make matters worse, acne became an issue. When I was out of school, I would walk around Portland near Burnside Street with no money to spend, just to burn time. Some people go watch movies. I watched drunks stagger around downtown and saw people get assaulted and one day robbed at the bus stop. The worst part of that year was how much I missed my mom and my brother. I wanted to move back with them, but I didn't want to hurt my dad, and I hated my stepdad. On weekends, I rode the Greyhound bus to Eugene to see my mom, and after the weekend was over, I hopped back on the bus and stared out the window, many times with tears streaming down my face on the ride back to my dad's. I wasn't truly happy in either place for different reasons. Soon I realized that things had to change, that the situation in Portland was dire. Feeling alone and isolated caused me to not give any effort to school or make friends. My grades were all D's and I was overweight and insecure. So I moved back in with my mom for my sophomore, junior, and senior years. I knew it hurt my dad, but I was miserable and felt desperate. I then attended Mohawk High School in Marcola. It was a small school in a small town. Marcola was a logging community with a lot of the guys working in the woods. I loved growing up in a small town, but like so many others from humble beginnings, I carried low expectations and no dreams. I wasn't looking down the road. The change of schools did help me because even though I never did my homework and I wasn't considered smart, I also wasn't dumb. I began to get good grades. I ended up getting straight A's when I was a senior. Sports not only provided an outlet for me, but I found direction in it. I played everything, and once I got back in shape and my feet under me, always was in the starting lineup on my teams. I was a wide receiver on our football team, and we were pretty good by my senior year. I became the leading scorer on the team, but that was mostly due to the fact that we had a great quarterback. Donnie Manila and I were pretty much best friends at the time, and we lived 3 miles apart on Windling Road, the same road our high school was on. Every day in the summer, I rode my bike to his house where I would run routes, catch ball after ball, lift weights, and go to the swimming hole where we'd cuss the Flatlanders, people from town. Donnie was one of Mohawk's best athletes of all time. All those days of him throwing me balls helped us develop a good connection, so he looked for me a lot during the games. Donnie, and mostly his dad, Don, planted seeds inside of me for when I started running. His dad was a dang good runner. He broke 40 minutes in the 10K, 6.2 miles, which isn't easy. Donnie and I ran together and raced each other. We began to call this the Windling Road Track Club. It wasn't long distance running, nothing compared to what I do now. It was something we did simply to get in shape for football. I discovered that I wanted to work hard to become the best athlete I could be. I liked being part of a successful team. I liked scoring touchdowns, and it was fun to see the work Donnie and I put in during the summer pay off. I also wanted to be a good student, but just like athletics, was never as good as Donnie, as he was in the Honor Society. Nobody was there pushing me or encouraging me. Nobody was in my face telling me I needed to do better. I don't ever remember being asked about my grades. I just wanted to do better on my own. Because of my up and down life, I learned to be self-sufficient. Now I was learning how to push myself. My mom was doing the best she could. I never for a moment doubted that she loved me. She always loved me, but there was a lot going on for her. She had remarried, was working, and had to care for two other little kids, my half-brother and half-sister, Taylor and Megan. She had Pete and me as well, of course, to try to corral. I was used to being on my own, so I didn't care as long as I was around my brother, even though we fought a lot over sports because we were so competitive. It was during this time frame I discovered I could motivate myself in sports. When I wasn't playing sports, what I remember most is trying to stay as far away from home as I could, because there's always a lot of tension if my stepdad was around. In the summer after my sophomore year, I found a safe haven at Grandma Heloise's house. In between playing catch, haying, or swimming, on most days I would ride my 10-speed bike 20 miles to my grandma's greenhouse on 24th and Emerald in Eugene. Grandma Heloise was my dad's mom. His dad died when he was 3 years old, so my dad grew up without a father, since my grandma never remarried. She was a school teacher who was kind and gentle, and she always cared for me. Grandma Heloise was always happy to see me. She would make me a plate full of saltine crackers with peanut butter, and I'd read a Stephen King book while she played either Mozart or Beethoven and read her book of choice as the grandfather clock audibly ticked the seconds off. I hung out there a lot, watched MTV, then rode the 20 miles back home only to do it all again the next day. I have good memories of being with my Grandma Heloise. Sure, I wasn't very productive at her house, but I still biked 40 miles a day. That was worth something because it helped me get in shape. A few times I remember my dad would come by. Back then he was still drinking, so I'd rarely go to his house, only Grandma's. Just a short way down from my grandma's house was Hayward Field, the famous track and field stadium for the University of Oregon. What was once a cow pasture has become the site of more U.S. Olympic trials and NCAA championships than any other venue in the country. Whenever there were track meets, I'd go over to Hayward Field and watch them through the fence that surrounded the field at the time, since I couldn't get in. There was also University Park that I would wander over to. They had this outdoor basketball hoop where I'd play ball with others. We got some really good games going. After my junior year of high school, I went to work at my grandfather's ranch in eastern Oregon during the summer. Grandpa Bob, my mother's dad, was a trainer of racehorses, and he was super tough. This was a guy who moved out on his own when he was 15 years old, then joined the army and served in Korea. Believe me when I say there was no babying going on when I worked for him. Papa taught me a lot about being super tough, as well as a lot about horses. I warmed up his racehorses at the track before I gave them to the jockey to race, so I was what they called a jockey boy. Holding a racehorse back is hard. You can't be too big because you don't want to put too much weight on a racehorse. I wasn't big, but I had to be pretty strong to hold those horses. Papa knew what he was doing. His talent as a trainer was matched only by his big personality and aggressiveness. He was once picked as the Quarter Horse Trainer of the Year in Oregon. He had a really good thing going, but it was mostly due to his hard work and never-ending drive to win. I learned something else from Grandpa Bob. I was taught that tomorrow is not guaranteed. My Nana, my mom's mother, drove over from their ranch in eastern Oregon to visit and go to my homecoming football game on a Friday. Late Thursday night, the Umatilla Sheriff's Department called and told us that Papa had died in an automobile accident. It was very painful to hear this, since Grandpa Bob was a big part of my teenage years. The following night, the homecoming game was tough to get through, but I had a good game and made some difficult catches. Papa taught me to give everything you have each day, and the only thing that mattered was winning. When a horse wins, the trainer, the jockey, and the family get to take a photo in the winner's circle. Anything less than that is a failure. By my senior year, I loved joking around with Manila. I'd stare at my hands and say, "These are the hands that are going to take us to state." Donnie and I had a good rapport, but even back then, I could see some of the traits that have led to my mindset behind hunting and training, because I don't remember the catches the most. What I remember the most about playing with Manila is one momentous drop. "I'll never drop a pass." Famous last words I love to always say to my quarterback. I will never forget my last game during my senior year. We were playing the Lowell Red Devils at Lowell and a game we would win 19-0, and I even scored a touchdown in that game. But I also dropped a two-point conversion, and it was the first pass I dropped all season. I was the biggest baby, pouting on the sidelines simply because I dropped a pass. That was my competitive nature rearing its ugly head. Even back then, I wanted to be the best. With football, I would learn very quickly after high school that I was, at best, an average player. In the Cam Haynes Dictionary, the word average has no meaning. My best wouldn't come from something that involved a ball. Are you good enough? This is a question every sport asks. As players go from high school to college to professional athletics, the answer most eventually come to is that dreaded two-letter word, no. I graduated high school younger than most at 17. I decided to work for a year at Safeway, where I ordered bread and dairy for the grocery store. Manila was a year behind me, so after he graduated the following year, we both went down to Southern Oregon State, where we tried to play college ball. Donnie managed to do it for 4 years and ultimately was a starter. I managed to drink a lot of alcohol. Along with Donnie, my college friends who were also on the team consisted of two guys from Portland, Keith and Joe, as well as Jeff Beathard. Jeff's dad, Bobby Beathard, was the general manager of the Washington Redskins, and he arrived with some East Coast crazy in him. I thought I was good at playing wide receiver, but Jeff had the best hands I had ever seen catching a football. He was the last pick in the 1988 NFL draft chosen by the Los Angeles Rams. After trying to make the team, I redshirted for Southern Oregon State, meaning every day I practiced against the starting defense. There were definitely some beasts out there on the field. I definitely wasn't one of them. It was fun, especially since there were some elite athletes on the field who eventually made it to the NFL. The irony of college was that throughout my high school years, I never drank even one beer. All I cared about was sports and grades. I knew I wasn't an elite athlete, but I still tried my hardest, especially because I wanted to impress my dad. What I learned at Southern Oregon was that even though I wasn't good enough to play college football, I knew how to party. I drank a lot of beer and eventually went back to Eugene with this new skill mastered. I began to go to Lane Community College, but mostly I just screwed around, drinking beer, not doing much of anything. I got a job at a warehouse, crushing cardboard boxes and making them into bales, all for $4.72 an hour, a job a monkey might very well be able to do. After I created big bales of cardboard, I stacked them up with a forklift so people could come and recycle them. The best part about this job, maybe the only good part, was that this was a place I met Tracy, my wife. Nothing about my life back then seemed unusual or extraordinary. I didn't feel like I was wasting any talents or opportunities because I honestly didn't feel like I had any. It wasn't like I was letting anybody down. Nobody expected anything from Cameron Haynes, so I didn't expect anything out of myself. My one and only direction in life, athletics, was suddenly gone, so I found myself pretty much lost. Nothing was challenging me. There was nothing I could point to I was good at except being a smartass, I guess. My mouth got me in a lot of trouble. There are people who mold you during your childhood, both in good and bad ways. They care for you like Grandma Heloise, or they teach you like Grandpa Bob did. They help challenge and motivate you like Donnie did. Family might provide an outlet, and friends may prove to be motivators, but ultimately, you have to decide to dream. You're the only person to push yourself. Confidence can come from others, but it still needs to be built inside of yourself. That takes time. After the Southern Oregon State experience, knowing I didn't have organized sports to do anymore, and realizing this meant I had no real focus in life, I was left wandering for a while. Thankfully, Roy kept on me and kept encouraging me to bow hunt, telling me it's way better than hunting with a gun, that there were fewer people, and that I would enjoy it. Roy got me started, but the only way I could build confidence in anything was to go out and do it. Soon, I focused my energy on bow hunting. Like athletics, it provided a challenge. This time, however, I had a different answer to that age-old question of whether I was good enough. Yeah, I'm good enough. In fact, I'm a lot more than that. I found the perfect thing to work hard at, something that challenged me and that not everybody was good at. When I was successful at bow hunting, it gave me a lot of confidence. And for a young man, having confidence and getting positive reinforcement in anything was a powerful spark for change in my life. Here's the truth. I'm an average guy who has experienced above average bow hunting success over the past 3 decades. One thing is for sure, if I can do it, anyone can. I came from nothing, and I had no one pushing me or even believing in me. For this reason, my story proves that, in bow hunting, the most average person can achieve the grandest of dreams. Confidence is everything in bow hunting. The bow hunter's arena is God's country, and the only witnesses are the hunter and the hunted. There are no crowds to push you on. You must be self-motivated. To experience victory, you have to be tough. And you don't get tough by thinking about it or delaying it. You must train for tough. You must believe that you can be tough. How can you take your passion to the next level?